Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Closing prices. Posted, $11.75. Futures, $15.06. Natural gas, $1.869. Benchmark U.S. rose $2.72 to $15.06 per barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Hello again. This is Kay reading the Odessa American for Thursday, April 30th, 2020, local and state. Council lifts shelter in place by Michael Merlo, M-M-E-R-L-O at OAOA.com. The City Council voted to update and extend the mayoral declaration of local disaster, which lifts Odessa's partial shelter-in-place order and opens up certain non-essential businesses within the city limits of Odessa. Basically, we are mirroring the governor since the governor has taken the lead. His orders supersede anything we can do unless we want to go even stricter than he wants. This is just an extension, Mayor David Turner said Tuesday. City Attorney Natasha Brooks said one of the major changes made was that the shelter-in-place will be lifted. We're trying to make this mayoral phase reopening so that it will follow the governor's orders, especially in the future. Turner still urged that Odessans practice social distancing whenever they are in public. The declaration also recommended wearing a mask. If we want to require more protection, that is a right of a city, he said, referencing other Texas cities that require the public to wear masks when leaving their homes. All council members agreed that they felt more comfortable recommending wearing a mask rather than requiring it. At-large Councilwoman Peggy Dean said, I don't think our police and our firemen have enough time to try to see if people are wearing a mask. District 2 Councilman Dewey Bryant said, we need to make sure that everybody understands this is the first step. We need to continue to be cautious and understand that we still have a problem out there and we don't want to step backwards. Newly appointed District 1 Councilman Michael Shelton Sr., who was appointed during an emergency meeting on Monday, attended Tuesday's virtual meeting. Turner said that council decided to have the emergency meeting to appoint Shelton so that he could participate in Tuesday's meeting. Council also approved the City of Odessa Police Department to apply for and accept awarded funds granted from the 2020 BJA Coronavirus Emergency Supplemental Funding Program for $242,862. A copy of Governor Greg Abbott's Executive Order GA-18 relating to the expanded reopening of services and part of the plan to open Texas can be found at tinyur.com/YB6JDF50. Man charged in fatal shooting booked into Ector County Jail. OA News at OAOA.com. The 22-year-old man who was arrested after he was reportedly involved in a fatal shooting in Pleasant Farms earlier this month has been extradited from Minnesota and booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. Michael Brian Thomas Hosh was charged with murder, a first-degree felony. Hosh reportedly fled Ector County after the April 1st shooting to Cambridge, Minnesota, where he was arrested and detained by Isanti County Sheriff's Office. Hosh was extradited to Ector County and booked into the jail on Tuesday, jail records show. He has one bond, totaling $200,000. Deputies were dispatched to a suspicious vehicle call at 11:30 a.m. April 1st, in the 6,000 block of West Lemon Street, an ECSO press release detailed. Upon arrival, deputies reportedly found the vehicle and a man, who was later identified as Logan Ray Hatfield, was found dead inside the vehicle. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Thursday, April 30th, 2020. Page 2, read. Photos. District 11 congressional candidate August Pfluger helps load cars with refrigerated food items at the food distribution event at the West Texas Food Bank on Tuesday night. A West Texas Food Bank volunteer marks a car with the amount of food kits to be received, along with general groceries, during the South Odessa distribution on Tuesday afternoon. City of Odessa fire engineer Julio Ramos helps load cars with food being distributed by the West Texas Food Bank on Tuesday afternoon. Cars line up outside of the West Texas Food Bank in advance of the scheduled food distribution on Tuesday afternoon, and there are a lot of cars lined up in this photo. Greg Stoker of WTFB said they served a total of 226 households on Tuesday night and distributed 11,300 pounds of food. THECB to launch payment assistance. OANews@OAOA.com. Austin, the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board announced Wednesday the upcoming September launch of a new loan repayment program benefiting recently appointed peace officers who have student loan debt. Many law enforcement agencies have difficulty filling vacant positions. In June 2019, Governor Greg Abbott signed into law SB 16, 86th Texas Legislature, authorizing the Peace Officer Loan Repayment Assistance Program, PLRAP, to provide an incentive for Texans to pursue law enforcement careers and remain on the job to help pay off their student loan debt. The legislation defines peace officer in the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, which describes 35 distinct positions and roles. To be eligible to apply for loan repayment assistance through PLRAP, an initial applicant must have been initially appointed as a full-time peace officer on or after September 1, 2019, have completed at least 1 year of employment as a full-time peace officer in Texas, and have earned at least 60 credit hours at an eligible Texas higher education institution prior to initial appointment as a peace officer. Upon admittance to the PLRAP, recipients will receive an initial award based on their 1 year of prior service. A successful applicant may receive up to $20,000 in loan repayment assistance over a period of 5 years, $4,000 annually, or one-fifth of the outstanding loan balance, whichever is less. Awards are contingent on available funding. In the initial year of the program, applications will be selected on a first-come, first-served basis until funds are no longer available. After the initial program year, priority will be given to prior year recipients, and initial applications will be selected on a first-come, first-served basis until funds are no longer available. Additional program requirements are posted on the PLRAP webpage. The coordinating board anticipates posting the online application in September. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Thursday, April 30th, 2020. Opinion. Worldview. Heartbreak on heartbreak. The tragedy of the Nova Scotia mass shooting. The Point. There remain large missing pieces in the story and many unanswered questions. Over and over, the same phrases were uttered by men and women across Nova Scotia. Surreal, senseless, no words. Why? But the full measure of shock and grief at the slaughter in their province didn't come from the lips, it came from the eyes. Haunted, red, glazed, bewildered. eyes seeking in some obscure middle distance rational answers to a horrifically irrational act. A 51-year-old man cut a murderous swath through rural Nova Scotia from late Saturday, April 18th, to early Sunday, April 19th, killing at least 18 people, leaving homes burned to the ground and cars torched at 16 separate crime scenes. As much as anyone, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau best described things when he said the slaughter, on top of the COVID-19 lockdowns that make it impossible for stricken family and friends to gather and mourn, is heartbreak on top of other heartbreaks. On hearing the news, he said, many Canadians probably asked themselves, how much more can we take? Trudeau has grown sadly familiar with the role of national consoler. Canadians have been killed in numbers of shootings at a St. Foy mosque and on Toronto's Danforth in the Yonge Street van attack, in the Humboldt Broncos bus crash, in the downing of Flight 752. The Prime Minister was able once again, by dint of emotional intelligence or political shrewdness, to strike the right notes. Even as opposition leader Andrew Scheer once again misread the moment, going on about the need for enhanced parliamentary sittings on a day when most Canadians could have cared less. The newest devastation unfolded in a manner fit for fiction, the suspect eluding police for some 12 hours by driving a mock RCMP cruiser and wearing a police uniform remarkable in their detail. It seems unlikely such extraordinary materials would have been assembled by someone who simply snapped. Rather, they seem to suggest extraordinary planning. Yet, no one acquainted with the killer seems to have noticed anything untoward. Local MP Lenore Zan said she heard from people who went to school with him, said he was such a nice guy, talked to him all the time, said he seemed to be fine. The rampage began in the community of Portapique, a cottage area so sleepy that signs around town spell it different ways. It's a place few Canadians had likely heard of, but a place that has become forever notorious after the killer left a list of dead that could have been pulled from a Tim Hortons ad. A grade school teacher, a nurse, a volunteer firefighter, healthcare workers from the Victorian Order of Nurses. In the Commons, Trudeau said RCMP Constable Heidi Stevenson, one of those killed, embodied the values that built this country: integrity, honesty, compassion. Trudeau acknowledged the acute pain of mourners being unable to come together, but he and health authorities properly insisted that social distancing measures in effect to combat the coronavirus pandemic must be maintained. Grieving will be done, but there will be few hugs, rather a virtual vigil in the style of spring 2020. On Monday, April 20th, there remained large missing pieces in the story and many unanswered questions about the police response. How, for example, did the killer manage to carry on spitting death and flames for 12 hours? His costumery helped him remain steps ahead of our investigators, Chief Superintendent Chris Leather of the Nova Scotia RCMP said somewhat sheepishly. And why was the province's emergency alert phone system not used? Good question. Such questions must continue. Nobody can lose their life in vain, said RCMP Commissioner Brenda Luckey, and Heidi will not lose her own in vain, nor will the other 17 victims. She and her force have work to do to make good on that promise. The Toronto Star. Guest view. Healthcare workers shouldn't have to decide between their own health and that of patients. By Senator John Cornyn, Houston Chronicle. In times of crisis, Texans are always eager to lend a hand. I think about those who came together in the wake of Hurricane Harvey to lead search and rescue operations clear debris, and rebuild their communities. Though the crisis we face today is an entirely different breed, that same Texas generosity is still easy to find. From organizations like the Houston Food Bank stocking families' pantries, to alcohol producers like Gulf Coast Distillers donating hand sanitizer, to a personal protective equipment, PPE, drive at Minute Maid Park, these stories are a reliable source of comfort and amid so much uncertainty. As Texans work together to flatten the curve and support one another, I'm continuing the fight in Congress to get the resources our healthcare workers and local leaders need. I recently held a video conference with members of the Texas Nurses Association and heard from Kimberly Curtin, a nurse practitioner at MD Anderson, about the need for additional PPE such as masks, gloves, and gowns. She said nurses are given a clean mask at the start of each shift, and that mask is supposed to last an entire day. After hours of wear, masks can become damp and soiled and carry germs from one patient to another. This practice is unsafe for both our healthcare workers and their patients. Congress has provided billions of dollars to increase our nationwide supply of PPE. Recent legislation included $16 billion for the Strategic National Stockpile to procure PPE and other medical supplies. It also provided $1 billion for the Defense Production Act to bolster domestic supply chains and speed up production for PPE, as well as ventilators and other urgently needed equipment. Our healthcare workers should never be in a position where they're forced to decide between their own health and that of patients, period. A key component of our ability to slow the spread and eventually defeat COVID-19 is through testing. The sooner we can identify positive cases, the sooner these individuals can self-isolate and notify those with whom they've been in contact. Congress has passed legislation to expand testing capacity and make testing free of charge for all Texans. Last week, we took another major step forward and provided an additional $25 billion to support and expand state-led testing. We also bolstered funding to support our hospitals. Urban and rural hospitals alike are being crushed by the weight of this virus, and they need financial assistance to survive. Congress has provided $175 billion to help our hospitals and healthcare providers keep their doors open. One of the cascading effects of this virus is the broader impact on our healthcare system. The surge in coronavirus led to a statewide postponement of elective surgeries. In the beginning, this made sense. We needed to free up medical resources to fight COVID-19. We must remember, though, that elective doesn't mean unimportant. Procedures covered by these cancellations include everything from cancer biopsies to organ transplants, and patients living with chronic pain who once had a surgery date, a sign of hope, had to continue living with the pain. A recent executive order issued by Governor Greg Abbott has loosened these restrictions and given hospitals the ability to perform procedures that aren't expected to reduce coronavirus response capacity. This is welcome news for Texans whose procedures have been postponed and marks a small but significant step toward restoring normal operations. As we look for that light at the end of the tunnel, it's important to remember that much is still unknown about COVID-19. While we are learning more and making progress every day, the right balance needs to be struck to ensure public safety. While Texans continue to support their communities, I want to thank those who are in the trenches battling this virus. Texas doctors, nurses, first responders, and healthcare workers make physical and emotional sacrifices every day to support their patients. These brave men and women offer more than life-saving care. They're a hand to hold, a friendly face, and a source of comfort for patients who are isolated from family and friends. Thank you to the healthcare workers who are keeping Texans safe. We stand with you. Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, is a member of the Senate Finance, Intelligence, and Judiciary Committees. U.S. Senator John Cornyn.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the education section of the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, April 28, 2020. Midland College Profiles by Travis Woodward. Midland College sets student on path to Texas Tech University. Like a lot of teens trying to find their way, Brandon Cruz was unsure of his future upon graduating from Lee High School in 2019. He found his path close to home at Midland College. A native of West Texas, Cruz is wrapping up his final semester and is on track to earn an associate degree this spring. He's planning to transfer to Texas Tech University and pursue a bachelor's degree. He has enjoyed living in Midland and wants to return once he receives his degree. Cruz's dad is in the energy industry. His mom is a counselor for Midland ISD. It is his mother who inspired him to press hard. Early on, Cruz and his family decided that it was best for him to stay close to home, at least initially. "My parents have always pushed me to do well in school and get a degree," Cruz said. "They told me that with vision, determination, and hard work, you can accomplish anything." He credits MC with creating a close-knit, nurturing community. Midland College has its own unique identity and culture. This campus opens up a lot of options. Once you find what you want to do, everything is here to get you started on your way. Cruz's long-term goal is to work in the energy industry. "I want to help companies manage finances and achieve their goals." Focused on his career, Cruz applied for and received a scholarship and mentorship from young professionals in energy. "YPE has given me an amazing opportunity to pursue my dream. I hope to one day play a part in the success of local businesses in the energy sector." The college's Associate Director of Scholarships, Aaron Casey Richardson, said that when YPE mentioned this opportunity for Cruz, it was a proud moment for MC Scholarships. "Here at MC, scholarships are one of the most important things we can do to help our students achieve their dreams. The YPE's offer to mentor Brandon will help provide him with an excellent education at Texas Tech that will forever change his life." Casey Richardson also thinks Brandon Cruz is exceptional. "Brandon is very focused and a driven student who has planned to attend Texas Tech since I met him in the fall of 2018. Brandon has emphasized his studies, and it is paying off. Midland College has more than 200 scholarship opportunities available. Thanks to generous donors, MC was able to award more than $1 million in scholarships during the 2019-2020 school year. When asked what advice he has for students considering going to college, Cruz said, "You should go to school and study as hard as you can. Take this opportunity and don't doubt yourself." Education Briefs from Staff Reports. UTPB to offer Master's in Mechanical Engineering. The University of Texas Permian Basin College of Engineering will be offering a Master's of Science in Mechanical Engineering starting in the fall of 2020. The new graduate degree is the college's first master's program to be offered. The graduate program will provide advanced training for engineers currently in the workforce, allowing them to perform at a higher level in their companies, according to a press release from UTPB. The need to recruit, retain, and educate the existing engineering workforce is a reason for establishing a UT Permian Basin graduate mechanical engineering program. The program will complement the existing undergraduate programs in chemical, electrical, mechanical, and petroleum engineering. The program will offer thesis and non-thesis options. GRE requirements currently are being waived. It will take 2 years for full-time students to complete their courses and earn their master's degree. The requirement to graduate is 30 credit hours for the thesis option and 36 hours for the non-thesis option. An all-star virtual graduation awaits college students. Though college students have seen their in-person graduations canceled or scaled back, one organization is promising to celebrate the class of 2020 with a virtual all-star celebration featuring Eva LaGoria, Andrew Yang, Liam Payne, and more. Her Campus, a website geared to women in college, is putting on an online ceremony it's calling I'm Still Graduating on May 15th that will feature speeches and performances from luminaries as well as words from select graduates. Students can also create their own graduation page and upload photo memories and a minute-long video to share with family and friends. We're turning the letdown of a missed graduation experience on its head and bringing together the lineup of our dreams to deliver commencement addresses and performances that will inspire, motivate, and uplift at a time that this year's graduates and all of us need it most, said Stephanie Kaplan Lewis, Her Campus Media's CEO and editor-in-chief. Other participating include Tamron Hall, Kenneth Cole, Olympic gold medalist Nastia Lukin, and tennis legend Billie Jean King. Making the grade, from Staff Reports. Midland College student Jacob Edwards has been named a Coca-Cola Gold Leaders of Promise Scholar by the Coca-Cola Scholars Foundation. The designation carries a $1,500 scholarship, according to a press release from MC. While at MC, Edwards was involved with the Honors Program and was president of Midland College Students in Philanthropy. He plans to transfer to the University of Texas Permian Basin in the fall and major in nursing. Also, Edwards and fellow MC student Kerry Brown were named to the All-Texas Academic Team by Phi Theta Kappa. Midlanders Tori Fikes and Michaela Malloy were initiated into Phi Kappa Phi at Texas A&M University. Membership is for the top 10% of seniors, top 7.5% of juniors, and top 10% of graduate students. Tiffany Vandergriff was inducted into Alpha Chi at Angelo State University. To be eligible, students must rank in the top 10% of the graduate students or seniors, or in the top 7.5% of juniors. Teachers must spend more time with students. Commentary by Jay Matthews. Michael Petrelli, a nationally known education policy expert, had a commentary in the Washington Post recently that apparently enraged nearly everyone who read it. The headline was, "Schools should consider keeping kids in the same grade this fall." Reader comments included, "I'm rolling my eyes so hard it hurts," and "My question is how this idiocy found its way into the Post." As outrageous as Petrilli's suggestion seemed, I saw it as a plea for creative thinking. In my experience, the most desperate school situations often produce the most useful reforms. Great teachers I have spent my life studying usually make their biggest strides when everything seems hopeless. That's about where we are now. The issue for me is time. The pandemic has robbed us of at least 3 months of learning. There may be even more losses. Some students and their families have made good use of online classes, but I sense for most, not much progress has been made. Petrilli suggested retrieving time by having all struggling students repeat the grade. That was bold, but impractical. teachers, I know, have done this in less obtrusive ways. Extra classes before or after school, lunchtime classes while kids munch their sandwiches, Saturday classes with pizza and games, special summer classes at the school or a nearby community college. I have seen devoted educators create more time for learning by disabling the loudspeaker in their classroom, refusing to let their students attend assemblies irrelevant to their lessons, or using timers to make sure they don't wander off track. Looking for more minutes in the day gets tricky because teacher unions may rightly demand more pay for more time. In this crisis, some extra money could be found. The point is to give teachers room to innovate. They know what is important. Less compelling parts of their official lesson plans can be discarded, at least in the short term, so their students can catch up. Teachers who have significantly raised achievement often have a passion for reading. Tom Torkelson and Joanne Gama persuaded their principal at an impoverished public school in Texas's Rio Grande Valley to extend their time so the last 90 minutes of every day were nothing but reading. Nearly all of their fourth and fifth graders were at least two grades behind. The teacher would read a short story out loud, then the class would do it, each child taking a turn. The teacher asked the students what they thought was happening. They read a bit, discussed the main idea, read more, then talked about what they had read. Sometimes each child would read with a partner, harnessing the conviviality of their age group by taking turns. The students gained confidence. They moved to more difficult books, making slow but steady progress. They went from being barely able to read on a second grade level to nearly all passing the state exams for fourth and fifth graders. Gama and Torkelson eventually created the IDEA Charter Network, which now has 53,000 students in 96 schools. But that's not the point. Most teachers aren't empire builders. Give them more time, and they can make great progress on a small scale, particularly if they know what they want to do with the extra hour or so. Mike Feinberg and his friend Dave Levin did the same thing with the chance, music, games, and teamwork they added to the Houston Public School class they created before they built the KIPP Charter Network. Feinberg told me teachers using distance learning right now are making careful notes about what is working well and what has lost time. Such insights can be useful when the children are back in the classroom.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Monday, April 27th, 2020. This article is entitled, "Don't Count Out the Hydraulic Fracturing Industry," by David Fickling, Bloomberg. There's one obvious group of losers from the global deal to cap oil output that's just been thrashed out: U.S. shale producers. For an industry that needs crude prices in the low $40 to break even, current levels below $30 a barrel seem so obviously bad that America isn't even being asked to offer a mechanism to deliver an expected output cut of 2 million barrels per day or more. Sheer economics should drive a fall of that magnitude, without any need for the sort of direct intervention that some U.S. regulators have proposed. At the same time, it's worth asking whether expectations of a normal mortal blow are overblown. In 2014, the last time a Saudi Arabian-led supply surge attempted to squeeze out shale producers, most analysts believed they needed $60 to $90 a barrel to make money. It didn't turn out that way. Far from wilting with lower prices, the shale industry used a tougher environment to push through long overdue productivity improvements. On the eve of the demand hit from coronavirus, the U.S. was pumping out 50% more oil than it was in 2014. There's a key difference between the shale industry and the rest of the oil and gas sector. Frackers are doing the same thing over and over again. Compared with vast conventional fields that can keep producing for decades, Shale plays are smaller and run dry after 3 or 4 years, putting producers on a constant treadmill of bringing new wells on stream. Despite accounting for less than 1/6 of the world's oil production, the U.S. is home to about 1/3 of its oil rigs. That repetition means that unconventional oil producers are constantly learning how to operate more efficiently, just like the manufacturers of computer screens, flat-screen televisions, and solar panels. Frackers' so-called learning rate is lower than those sectors. One 2017 study estimated that it was around 3.2% during the 2014 oil price crash, compared with the double-digit figures for renewable technologies. Even so, it could still be enough to drive efficiencies not accessible to other players. Shale producers will be able to cut costs by 16% this year, according to Rystad Energy, a consultancy, compared with a 10% reduction for conventional onshore and 12% drop for offshore players. Where could the costs come from? One of the most obvious places is bankruptcy. A standard way of reducing spending is to use less infrastructure to serve more wells. But the patchwork nature of mineral leases normally makes that difficult. Pushing small producers to the wall provides an opportunity for more solvent players to buy up assets and consolidate their production. The bankruptcy process itself will help to write off debts for the companies forced to endure it. Lower oil prices certainly won't help the sector's chronic inability to post positive cash flows. Lower finance costs, however, might. Another benefit may come from the rising number of wells that have been drilled but aren't pumping yet. In the Permian Basin of West Texas, this so-called frack log is at some of its highest levels on record. Even before the coronavirus hit to demand, many frackers were happy to keep their wells mothballed because a shortage of pipelines made it hard to get crude to market. As both demand and export capacity start to recover over the next 18 months or so, those wells represent a huge volume of sunk spending that can be brought to market at marginal cash costs that would typically be below $20 a barrel. With nearly 3,500 such wells in the Permian alone, that represents some 2.5 million barrels a day of production at current output levels. Sunk costs aren't the only place where savings can be found. The oil services sector has been plagued with overcapacity since the 2014 downturn, and dealing with that excess has been one of the biggest drivers of cost reductions. IHS Markets Upstream Capital Costs Index typically follows moves in the oil price, rather than vice versa, as lower revenues force the industry to find new efficiencies. One of the biggest cost items for bringing already drilled shale wells into production is proppant, the sandy mixture that must be forced into deposits to crack open the rock and release the hydrocarbons trapped inside. The Midwestern sand that was traditionally shipped to oil-producing regions at vast costs has now been almost entirely replaced by lower quality but far cheaper local grains. Share prices of frac sand producers like Hi-Crush Inc. and U.S. Silica Holdings Inc. are at pennies on the dollar relative to where they were a few years ago. While that's bad news for them, it's good for the companies that use their products. It's possible the post-2014 efficiency gains seen in the U.S. shale patch were a one-time phenomenon, and cost-cutting has reached its natural limits. If that's right, it's likely that America's oil industry will never recover from this latest assault. If, on the other hand, they were part of an ongoing downward cost trend, don't ignore the possibility that the sector will eventually bounce back. What doesn't kill the frackers may well make them stronger. This article is entitled, "Saudis Begin Curbing Oil Output Ahead of OPEC Plus Start Date," by Javier Blas, Bloomberg. Saudi Aramco began reducing oil production earlier this week ahead of the May 1st start date for OPEC Plus output cuts, according to a Saudi industry official familiar with the matter. Aramco has begun to curtail production from about 12 million barrels a day to achieve the agreed level of 8.5 million barrels a day, the person said, asking not to be named discussing private information. The country joins fellow OPEC members Kuwait, Algeria, and Nigeria in kicking off cuts early. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, 23 nations in all, agreed this month to slash global supply by 10% in an effort to balance a market roiled by the coronavirus crisis. Although the cutbacks will amount to an unprecedented 9.7 million barrels a day, crude prices have continued to slide as worldwide lockdowns wipe out demand. Aramco is likely to be pumping at its targeted levels slightly ahead of May 1st, the person said. Rather than an effort to quick-start the output cuts, the gradual reduction reflects the several days that Aramco needs to adjust production safely. The company said it couldn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Kuwait said 2 days ago it had started cutting output oil early as it felt responsibility to respond to market conditions. Algeria also said this week that its supply curbs would start immediately. Meanwhile, Nigeria said it plans to cut production regardless of the May 1st start date because it has no more storage space available, the Premium Times reported. This article is entitled "Negative Oil Prices Were a Warning, Not an Anomaly," by Julian Lee, Bloomberg. Crude oil's collapse into negative prices on Monday was a clear warning of just how scarce storage space for oil is getting. Prices below zero are the market's way of telling producers to stop pumping now. Dismissing the historic move in the May contract for West Texas Intermediate crude as, quote, more of a financial thing than an oil situation, unquote, as U.S. President Donald Trump did, misses the point. People left holding that contract when trading ceased on Tuesday would have had to take delivery of the oil at the Cushing storage hub in Oklahoma. But with the world awash in oil, there was nowhere for them to store it. So they had to get rid of that obligation at almost any price. The situation has arisen because there is still simply too much crude being produced in a world that can't use it. The output cuts agreed to on April 12th, after a four-day standoff between Mexico and the other members of the OPEC Plus alliance, haven't yet made a barrel of difference to supplies. They are only just starting to be implemented by a handful of participants, with most, including the two biggest, Saudi Arabia and Russia, unlikely to make meaningful reductions before the deal officially comes into force on May 1st. Meanwhile, about 40 million barrels of Saudi crude is headed for the U.S., alongside with at least 11 million barrels from Iraq, all of it due to arrive by the start of June. Signs elsewhere are just as discouraging. Non-OPEC producers simply aren't reacting quickly enough. U.S. production hasn't fallen nearly as dramatically as weekly data from the Energy Information Administration appear to show. More comprehensive monthly data from the same source suggests the drop is about half of that implied by the weekly numbers and over a period that's four times as long. My colleague David Fickling noted that other benchmark crude grades, such as North Sea Brent, don't have the same physical delivery requirements as West Texas Intermediate, which may give them some protection from falling into negative territory. But Intercontinental Exchange, Inc., a leading provider of online marketplaces and clearing services for global trading, commodity trading, is already preparing Brent crude contracts for negative trading. And some physical crudes priced at big discounts to Brent are already very close to zero. Meanwhile, the lack of storage space at Cushing that triggered West Texas Intermediate's sub-zero dive doesn't look likely to improve by the time the June contract expires, although the realization that prices can actually turn negative may help report a repeat in mid-May. But it's not just at Cushing that storage capacity is running out. Indian storage tanks are nearly full. Tankers full of crude are starting to build up off the coasts of America and well-known floating storage areas like South Africa's Saldanha Bay, Even where there is still space in tanks, it has mostly already been reserved, making it unavailable for use. Desperate times call for desperate measures. In Europe, refined products are even being stored on barges. In the U.S., pipeline operator Energy Transfer LP is looking to free up space in its conduits in Texas to store 2 million barrels of crude. And a director of Ukraine's state-owned oil company, Naftogaz Ukraini, has suggested storing non-Russian crude in an underutilized pipeline network, which could theoretically hold as much as 35 million barrels. Even solutions like these will only delay the inevitable. Unless producers start cutting supply much more aggressively, another bout of negative prices will have to jolt them into action.
Alternate injection site for vaccine. Dear Dr. Roach, I read your recent column on the value of the shingles vaccination. In 1991, I had a mastectomy, and as a precautionary measure, I had my other breast removed in 1994, with all lymph nodes removed in both arms. After my surgeries, my instructions were never to have blood taken, blood pressure, or injections in either arm. I followed those instructions with a great deal of difficulty all these years. I went to my local pharmacies to get the shingles shot in my butt or thigh. No one would do it. My internist does not have the vaccine. In your opinion, is it safe for me to get the shingles shot in my arm? I am so afraid of getting lymphedema. Anon. Answer. Lymphedema is swelling in an extremity caused by damage to lymphatic vessels. Cancer can damage the lymphatic vessels, as can surgery and radiation. A breast cancer patient with your risk factors, lymph node dissection, has stage 0 lymphedema. Because they are in danger of developing lymphedema swelling, people with a history of breast cancer and your risk factors are given the advice you were given. I imagine it must have been hard to be so meticulous for nearly 30 years. I would not recommend getting the vaccine in the arm if there were a safe and effective alternative. I contacted GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturer of Shingrix, who told me that although the vaccine was only studied when administered in the deltoid, shoulder muscle, the anterior lateral thigh is an acceptable alternate location to give the vaccine, which I also confirmed with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. If the pharmacy staff are uncomfortable giving the vaccine there, and I can understand why, then you might arrange to get the vaccine from the pharmacy and bring it to your doctor, who can give you the dose in his or her office. I have done this for my patients. To your good health, Dr. Keith Roach. Roach's column appears Tuesdays through Saturdays. Readers may write him at P.O. Box 536-475, Orlando, Florida, 32853-6475.
Dear Abby, feud between two brothers is spilling over to their parents. Dear Abby, my husband and I have two sons in their late 30s. We always thought they got along well and loved each other. Over the past year, they are no longer speaking with each other because of hard feelings over current situations. They live in the same neighborhood. My husband refuses to stay at either one's house now when we visit from out of town because he's so upset at the turn of the events. We have been getting a hotel room. When I stayed on my own, I stay with our older son because there is no place to stay with a younger one. The disagreement between my husband and me is I want to continue to visit as I have, understanding there are differences, but hoping they will come to a solution. I refuse to choose one over the other, and I'm trying to be consistent with love and be a good role model. Both of our sons know this. My husband is upset with me because I don't support his position of not staying at either house until they make up. This is creating more friction in a situation that is already breaking our hearts. What do you recommend? We have made our suggestions for a resolution, but these are grown men who must do the work themselves. Mom in a difficult spot. Dear Mom, I recommend you continue to do what makes you comfortable. Your sons both know you love them. If your husband thinks that you're staying in a hotel, provided you can find one during the current shutdowns, will somehow manipulate your sons into settling their differences more quickly, he is mistaken. It hasn't worked so far. As you stated, your boys are grown men. I agree with you that they will have to hash this out on their own. Dear Abby, my fiancé often leaves memory cards out on his dresser after a day of being home alone. I was by myself one day and looked at them. There were photos of a nude woman wrapped in his bed sheet on his bed back in 2018. In them, she is posing. We were dating when they were taken, but not yet living together or engaged. He dabbles in photography, but never mentioned this or informed me he was doing this shot. I found another set from 2017 prior to our relationship that is not as tastefully done. Do I have reason for concern? I thought these things were professionally done on site. His bedroom, though? Uneasy in New York. Dear Uneasy, if the photos were taken before you and your fiancé were exclusive, I doubt you have any reason to worry. However, rather than ask me if you have anything to be concerned about, any questions you have about his dabbling would be better addressed directly to him. Dear Abby, I have a grown daughter whom my ex-husband named Brenda. It is her middle name. She's married, a mother of five, and lived abroad for quite some time. She's back in the U.S. now and living 50 miles away from our family. She now wants to be called by her first name, which is Riley. The problem is everyone here at home knows her as Brenda. Presently, I still call her Brenda. How can this be resolved? Not happy in the South. Dear Not Happy, resolve this by using the name your adult daughter prefers. If you refuse, expect the distance between you to become greater than 50 miles.
Jacqueline Biggers Stars. Note, Biggers Stars is based on the degree of your sun at birth. The sign name is simply a label astrologers put on a set of degrees for convenience. For best results, readers should refer to the dates following each sign. A baby born today has a sun in Taurus and a moon in Leo. Happy birthday for Thursday, April 30, 2020. You will be respected by those who work under you and achieve greatness this year. Professional and protective, you help and save a child. Do not overindulge in food and drink. If single, be careful of giving up your power. If attached, you wish to be cared for and left alone. It is a time to be flexible. You make more of an effort and romantic bliss is ensured. Leo loves lots of affection. The stars show the kind of day you'll have. 5 dynamic, 4 positive, 3 average, 2 so-so, 1 difficult. Aries, March 21 through April 19. 5 stars. Today puts you in a childlike frame of mind. you will be in the mood for entertainment and will feel especially creative. Things should be rosy in your love life, too. Romantic aspects suggest possible surprises, such as plans with your partner. Tonight, date night. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. 2 stars. Beware of family squabbles. Stubbornness abounds, and disagreements might become heated. Passions run high, but harmony can be achieved by taking deep breaths and giving everyone involved a true chance to say their piece. Tonight, take time out for a family dinner. Gemini, May 21 through June 20. 4 stars. You find yourself busier than usual on the phone or running errands. Friends, partners, or family will be of help. This is a day when you can rely on old friends, particularly to come through. Small purchases are also favored. Tonight, catch up with yourself. Cancer, June 21 through July 22. 3 stars. Do not go overboard financially while trying to woo a loved one. Watch your attitude with superiors. You could say the wrong thing if you are not careful. All might not be as it seems regarding work matters. Rumors abound. Tonight, relax. Leo, July 23 through August 22. 3 stars. Enthusiasm and energy run high today. Be careful with any type of risk-taking behaviors, as you might get burned. Jealousy might occur in relationships. Trust yourself to know what to do and use your leadership skills to smooth over any difficulties. Tonight, take off. Virgo, August 23 through September 22. 5 stars. Get busy behind the scenes preparing for many new beginnings that will take place later in the summer. Evening hours are favored. There might be some financial snafus, so remember Murphy's Law and always have a backup plan. Tonight, celebrate yourself. Libra, September 23 through October 22. 5 stars. Your charm and sex appeal are at an all-time high. Approach colleagues and professional groups with your ideas, and they will be well received. Powerful people will enter your life. Your social life will heat up interestingly. Tonight, a meeting online with a new person. Scorpio, October 23 through November 21. 5 stars. How can you miss? Today, you cannot. Be sure to take advantage of the particularly fortuitous opportunities to go after what you want. Avoid romantic indiscretions, as things could backfire in embarrassing ways. Tonight, it's like Oscar night, and you win. Sagittarius, November 22 through December 21. 5 stars. You meet a wealthy individual online from another state or country who changes your life in a delightful way. Those of you already happily married have a new business partner, one with money or means of attainment. Tonight, do not cease your exploring. Capricorn, December 22 through January 19. 5 stars. Today is the time for the search. If you are looking for funding for a future endeavor, capitalize on today's aspects. Accept the many inspirations that come your way. You adjust easily to any changes. Tonight, valuable time with an infant or elderly relative. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18. 2 stars. Love appears in a surprising way. If attached, your mate, who has been playing off the wall recently, feels as if he has been cast out in a rowboat in the middle of rapids. If single and you begin an involvement now, you have to make a choice. Tonight, think. Pisces, February 19 through March 20. 3 stars. Exciting new work opportunities come your way this June. To prepare, you must attend online an important business function. Money is very much needed by your household, and it doesn't seem like you have much choice. Tonight, go ahead and pout. Born today, writer Annie Dillard, 1945, director Jane Campion, 1954, actress Kirsten Dunst, 1982.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.